Greetings and welcome to Mind Matters News. We're talking to Dr. Yorgos Mapouras about his new and interesting paper, Turing Test 2.0, the General Intelligence Threshold. And we're going to continue our talking about this. The idea is whether or not AI is intelligent. And the classical definitions of this come from the Turing test. Last time we talked about why the Turing test is probably insufficient. So Dr. Mapouras has come up with a new method called the Turing test 2.0 for measuring intelligence. And that's what we're talking about. And the paper is called the Turing test 2.0, again, the general intelligence threshold. And we haven't dug too deep in here, so let me start out. George, by the way, welcome. Welcome back. It's good to have you back. Could you outline the three rules that define whether a test qualifies under the Turing test 2.0?
Right. So in the paper, I define three rules for a test to be a valid Turing test 2.0. It's like a framework that can help you. You can use it to generate such tests, right? So there's three rules. The first rule is that a system will have, we will transfer to the system through training or through hard coding, some amount of functional information. And from what we talked about in the previous episode, this is a group of functionalities. So things that we expect the system to be able to do. The second thing is that we have to give to the system information that maybe is non-functional. What do we mean by that? That the system doesn't know yet how to use it.
This is what we call before the flash of genius. It has to come up with something that it hasn't been trained on.
Yeah, so some information that is not functional for the system. We have to know that the system doesn't know how to extract the functionality, has not yet extracted the functionality from that information. So we have two sets. First rule, a set of functional information, it has some functionality. Second rule, a set of non-functional information. And then the third rule is that no other external training, external functionality has to be imported to the system. So after that, we can, let's say, try to interact with the system and try to see if it can come with new functionality based on the information we gave it. So to use the example we used in the previous episode about the anecdote about, okay, we have the apple falling from the tree, you can extract Newton's theory out of it. So the idea would be, I give you enough information that we know it's enough to extract the new theory, the new functionality. Can you showcase that you can do that? And it's not just showcase randomly, right, that maybe you spit out some random thing that happened to be true. But after that point, you have to show that you can always reuse this knowledge. So an example that it's easy to understand is that let's say an array, right? And you might know how to find an element in that array. And then you ask the question, what if the array is sorted, right? And the system has to come with a binary search where it's a more efficient way to search an array if you know that it's sorted to find a specific element if it's inside the array. And then if I ask it later, the next day or a year after, it has to know to reuse that knowledge. That knowledge is not lost, but it's able to reuse it and say, oh yeah, if the array is sorted, I can do it more efficiently. I learned that. I can always apply this functionality from now on. So it's not a functionality that will showcase one randomly, but you have to consistently be able to show that, yes, I learned this new functionality and now I can use it.
So again, I kind of equate the idea of non-functional information with a flash of genius. And I think that that's how we can tell that human beings are creative, because we've all had flashes of genius. We get a solution which pops into our head and we're not sure where it came from. And history is replete with people that have had flashes of genius. I think one was Tesla for the brushless motor. He said he's walking along the beach and he said, like a flash of lightning, it came to him. And he brushed off some stuff and brushed off some dirt and actually drew a schematic in the dirt, the same one that he used when he published the paper. Friedrich Gauss said he woke up in the morning and said he had the solution to this problem he'd been working on. And he said he had no idea where it came from. And it also comes from the arts. People have flashes of genius, for example, of writing music. You hear people, for example, saying, I don't know where it came from. I'm too afraid to examine it because I'm afraid it might go away. So we all have these flashes of genius, this non-functional information, which humans have access to. And I think it is a key marker of intelligence. And you mentioned last time, which I think was very interesting and true, that you see no path to achieving this goal. And in fact, the attempts that have been made, you know, AI writing better AI, writing better AI, writing better AI, I think it's been debunked. And I don't think it's conclusive, but I think there's just lots of evidence. There's something called model collapse, wherein that if you use AI to write better AI, pretty soon, yeah, you're not going to get new information and it kind of becomes a blubbering idiot. But that's the source of another talk sometimes. In your experiments, you gave a bunch of examples. Why did you choose the task like drawing a clock at, I think it was 6:30, or generating a hexagonal stop sign?
Yeah.
By the way, when I took my driver's test, I missed that on the test. It says, how many signs do a stop sign have? And I missed that. It was back when I was 16 and I missed it. It was the only one that I missed on the thing. I thought, well, you know, it's a regular polygon, but I'm not sure. So I guessed wrong. So tell me about the 6:30 and the hexagonal stop sign, and what does it reveal about large language models?
Right. So this all again came kind of as a almost a coincidence. Things were, in the previous episode, we talked about the Chinese room argument.
Yes.
And how it shows that the person inside does not have real knowledge of what he's reading. And this came kind of almost like an accident. I was watching the videos explaining what is the Chinese room argument, counter arguments. Then I see a random video where there's a person talking about a problem AI has, that it cannot draw accurately the time. And the interpretation why is because the images on the internet, which typically is what AI uses as training data, mass data from the internet, tend to have a specific picture of clocks or watches, right? That point to the what we call the 10-2. So the clock hands typically are in the 10-2 position. And the reason they do that is for cosmetic reasons. It's considered that this is the best image if you want to showcase a clock or a watch.
Oh, that's right. You go into a clock store, and if the clocks aren't running, they all have their hands at the same place.
Yeah. They were talking about in a funny way. Oh, this is funny. All the images are like that. AI cannot produce other images easily.
Oh.
And I was like, wait a second, that's interesting. So they were actually being very, let's say, very casual about it. But I was like, this is very interesting. Why it cannot, right? It's something very simple. So then looking at what we already discussed, I said, wait a second. Does AI, though, know how a clock works? Because if you know how a clock works, that's enough information to draw any picture. So then I went back to the AI and I followed the Turing test rules, the Turing test 2.0 rules, right? And I said, okay, can you draw images? Yes, you can draw images. So this is the functionality it already has. Can you draw images of a clock? It can. It gives you very nice images of clocks. It already has this functionality. This is the number one, my first rule for a Turing test 2.0. So then I looked at non-functional information, meaning is that information that it's enough if you know that, if you really understand it, to draw any clock.
Oh, that's a great example. Yes.
So I asked the AI, how does the clock work? They give a perfect description of how the clock works with the minutes, seconds, everything. And even you can ask it, can you tell me where the hands of the clock are going to be if it's 6:30? And they will describe it in detail accurately. They'll tell you, oh, the hour should point at 6. A little bit past 6, actually they're very accurate, a little bit past 6, and the minute hand will point at 6, because it's 6 times 5 is 30. So I was like, all right, you have all the information you need. You pretty much gave me the image, but in a text form. So then I will ask you to generate that image that I described, and it fails. It gives you a random, a 10-10 or something close by, And that shows that it doesn't have understanding, that it cannot extract the meaning of the things it's giving you. So if it doesn't have a meaning, how can it get functionality out of it, right? And this is the third rule. Now, this is where the third rule can break. The third rule says of the Turing test 2.0 says there should be no other external functionality come from, right? So one can think that this problem is kind of simple actually to fix. We just have to balance our data set, the training set, give you more images of different times, label them correctly, train the model, and fix this problem. The problem is easy to fix, yes, but then you're not testing for intelligence anymore because you broke the third rule. You gave it external information. So that's why it's a good test, is because of how the nature of the data that are used for these large models. They go to the internet and get what is out there, pretty much.
I like this very much. Here's an idea that popped into my mind. If all the literature in the world said that the world was flat, but it also knew things like, well, the North Star changes as you travel, and that when ships disappear in the distance, that they disappear from the bottom to the top. And it could take that information and say, you know, this idea of a flat Earth, it doesn't line up with these sort of things. So it's that sort of correlation that will generate this non-functional information. So tell me about the hexagonal stop sign test that you did.
Right. So after I noticed the behavior with the 6:30, right, with the clock, I wanted to make sure first that this is not just something random I stumbled upon, but I can actually reproduce it with other images, right? So what was unique about the 6:30 that we have an image that is very, let's say, dominant in the data set. So I asked myself, what other images we have that are dominant like that? And I started thinking about cases. Actually, in the paper, I give other examples too that I didn't really present in the paper, but I'm like, you can try them out if you want. And one of them that came to my mind was like the stop sign. So if you look at a stop sign, it has a very specific image, right? It has it's an octagon, and it has a very specific, like you have a red sign, white letters. So I'm like, okay, the AI has seen that image many, many times. There's likely it hasn't seen some specific shapes. For example, what if it's a hexagonal? What if I wanted to do the same exact thing, but this time in a hexagonal shape? And I noticed that AI had big difficulty doing that. When I tested different models, ChatGPT, if you insist a lot, it was able to produce an image. But then if you reset your chat, it would fail again, and you have to try hard to make it produce the same image again, the correct image again. So it's what I said before, is that if you really want to pass the Turing test 2.0, you have to see that if you extract some knowledge, that knowledge doesn't go away, but you are able to apply it again. And there are other things like that that you can kind of play with, like, for example, in triangular flat screen, right?
Oh, yes.
Because flat screens typically have a specific shape. Or a a car license plate in weird shapes. So sometimes depending, because for example, you can think that, oh, there are different signs in different shapes. AI is very good at correlation, right? Getting one thing, applying the other thing on top of it. So there is a niche there that you can start looking at, looking at these images that are very, very unique.
So this is very interesting, because as a watcher of sitcoms, it was either on The Office or Arrested Development where they came up with this, I think it was The Office, they came up with this idea for a triangular screen. So I'm wondering, you know, if that exists, but if it did exist, certainly that the large language models didn't catch up on that. You know, my experience, George, is that a lot of these large language models go and they put band-aids on things, and stuff that didn't work, you know, last year kind of worked this year. A classic example, I was informed and I checked it out and it was true. And it was Tom's mother has three kids, Snap, Crackle, and now if you know about Rice Krispies, their logo is Snap, Crackle, and Pop. So yeah, Pop was the last one. Tom's mother had three kids, Snap, Crackle, and, well, of course, it was Tom's mother. So it was Tom. It should have been Snap, Crackle, and Tom. So this was something that was answered incorrectly a long time ago, but it was corrected. Somebody went in, and I don't think it was training. I think it was a human being that went in and corrected that. I suspect that if they do identify the problems that you're talking about, people at OpenAI or Grok are going to come in, and they're going to put a Band-Aid on this and fix it. But it's going to be a human intervention. It isn't an epiphany of the AI, is it?
Exactly. This breaks actually the third rule of the Turing test 2.0, because what will happen is that external sources, in this case humans, will come and give this functionality to AI. And that's why it's important to preserve the third rule. And that's why these tests, yeah, they're nice, but very likely they're going to go away as we add more functionality on AI systems.
Yeah, and I think a lot of that is being done by human beings behind the scene.
Exactly.
Yeah. They go in and they tune all the errors. In fact, if you go to some of these large language models and they make a mistake, you can say, you made a mistake, blah, blah, blah. And they will come back and they'll go, oh, you're exactly right. And they'll fix it. And the next time you won't see that same mistake again. So it is apparently self-correcting. I hope that it verifies it before it corrects. But it is self-verifying. And also, I think that humans are that way. One of the things that I tried a long time ago is to tell ChatGPT not to do something. I said, draw a picture of Times Square with no pink elephants, or no pink rhinoceroses, I think it was. And I says, no pink rhinoceroses. It didn't know how to not do that. So give me a picture of Times Square with a rhinoceros in it, a pink rhinoceros. And I tried it on a bunch of other things, but they have fixed that then. I retried it, and I don't know if it came to the attention of the people that do these images, but I tried it, you know, just a few months ago, and I said, no pink rhinoceros is it, and it recognized it. So somebody behind the scenes is dinking with this stuff, making it more and more accessible. So that's interesting. So let me ask you about this. You talk about, I think it's Cholet, C-H-O-L-L-E-T. How would that be pronounced? Do you know? Cholet's definition of intelligence. Francois Cholet.
Oh, yeah. I don't know how to pronounce his name.
Okay. Let's go with American.
I would say Cholet. Yeah, but
Cholet. Okay.
I don't know. So, yeah.
Yeah. I'm in Texas. We have this road here called P-O-G-U-E, which of course is French and it should be Pogue, but everybody calls it Pogue. It's Pogue Road. And there's another one, B-O-S-Q-E, which should be Bosque, I believe, but everybody calls it Bosque.
So I'm
everybody,
the last person to judge about accents. Yeah,
okay. So we'll call it Collet's definition, and we apologize to Francois. I got his first name, Francois Collet. About this, he was a employee of Google when he published this, and he proposed a definition of intelligence. And you talk about that in your paper. Could you unpack this? I found this as interesting, and I confess I had not heard of this definition of intelligence. Yeah. I kind of like it.
Yeah. Actually, when I first started digging around, I came across his paper, and I found it very interesting. It actually has a whole benchmark. So it's more detailed, as in it's a whole benchmark that you can actually apply to a model and see how good it does. So the difference there is that Collet comes with a specific test, which a lot of people do, but his test is a little bit different than other researchers. And he says, I have this type of tests that are like kind of unique, meaning it's kind of like playing a game that you haven't really seen before. Okay.
Yeah.
And these games, if somebody Googles Collet's work, they can go to the website. They can even play the games themselves. So it pops up on your web, and you can actually do the test yourself to test yourself. And it's actually pretty much what I would call IQ tests. If anybody is familiar with IQ tests, they will probably get an idea of what I mean. Where you have some patterns, and then you have to predict the next one. So it gives you, but rather than being random numbers or whatever, it's let's say it's adjusted for computers. So you have pretty much, let's say, a grid. Each grid has some squares inside, and the squares have colors and positions in the grid. And it gives you, let's say, three different variations where the the squares in the grid from one variation to another, they change either in colors or in position. And what you have to do is detect this pattern and predict the fourth grid. So that's why I'm saying it's like, if anybody ever solved a Q test, it's very similar. It's like a Q test adjusted for computers. That's the description I would give. And it's very nice because you test a computer if you can kind of reason in a way. That's how it feels like. And a lot of other people did other tests. The other tests that, to be honest, why I like Colette is that because other tests might be something like, for example, people propose, can you get inside a typical house and find the coffee machine and make coffee? Okay, good, but why is that intelligent, right? Colette has a little bit more close to intelligence because you're trying to reason and find something that needs you to what we call think, right? What I don't like about this, though, it's the major thing that I think is common almost to all prior work in this field, is that we compare in order to figure out if it's clever enough, if it reaches the general intelligence, we compare it to human results. And I'm like, okay, again, which human? The average human? Should we get right. The smartest?
A guy and, that goes to a kindergarten kid? Yeah.
Exactly. And even a human that is not smart in this way might be smart in another way. I've seen it through my friends and family that somebody might be not as good in math, maybe very good at physics, maybe not good at physics, very good at painting, maybe not painting, maybe sports. And you can see the intelligence there. You can see how they innovate. So that's why I don't like these very specific, very tailored tests because, okay, it's a specific type of intelligence. And the other thing, that because I've taken tests like that before, IQ tests for different exams and stuff. If you take the test the first time, you're probably not going to do so well. The second time, you're going to do better. The third time, even better. Am I becoming smarter?
Sure.
Or am I just training and learning the patterns? You see what I mean? So if I'm learning the patterns, then sure, AI can do that. We know they can do that. But that's not what we're seeking to find. If you can learn patterns. Yeah, the AI, as the more you're training with this type of test, it will do better, eventually probably better than humans. But yeah, it recognizes patterns, no real intelligence. Because if a test, every time you take it, you can do it a little bit better, then it's just training. And this is my biggest, let's say, objection to this type. It's a very nice test, but like the Turing test, like the original Turing test, I think it doesn't really measure intelligence. And that's my biggest, let's say, critique, is that why we test machines on things we are good at, right? And not the machine. Yeah. For example, there was a time where the machines were not good at doing high precision math. They could only do a small precision. We actually used to use humans for high precision, right? Yeah, then they became better than us.
And they were known as computers, I think, right?
Exactly, yeah. So why don't we use that test? Computer is very good at it, right? What if I want the same action repeated precisely over and over again? Humans are terrible at it. Machines are great at it. But and that's exactly how I came with the Turing test 2.0. I was like, in order to be able to get with a test, I first have to define what does it mean to be intelligent? What does it mean to be general intelligent? What is this thing we're looking for? And that's how we, as we discussed in the previous episode, I came with this idea of what we call creativity. And I define it as being able to extract new knowledge out of existing information. Information you already have. So it's not like you need to go get other new information that you don't have. I already gave you that information. Can you extract new knowledge? What does it mean knowledge? So it means, can you apply what you learned? Did you get new functionality out of it? And this is actually how good teachers test students. Like in an exam, what is a good exam is to show that what they learned, they can apply it in a different environment, right? You can see that, you learned, let's say, the Fourier transform. Okay, here is a problem. I'm not going to tell you that the Fourier transform is needed, but you have to think about it. Be like, oh, here, this is a good solution. Can I apply it? If you applied it correctly, it means you have knowledge of it, right? So this is what it means to extract new knowledge out of it. And I like that because you can see it actually how some teachers teach. Some teachers, when they teach, they don't tell you the solution. They try to guide the students to the solution, and they will yes. tell you, think about this. So for example, we talked about the binary search that works in a sorted array. And the teacher...
What kind of search again?
The binary search. When you try to search...
Binary search.
An element in a sorted array, and you can do it faster than just simply checking each element individually, right?
Okay.
And maybe the students don't know about the binary search, and the teacher tries to teach them. And says, what about if the array is sorted? And the students don't know what to do. And then tell them, what if I pick a random element in the array? What can I learn from that? And then the students will be like, oh, a random element. Oh, and because it's sorted, what I'm looking for, it would either be on the right or the left of this element. And then they can kind of lead them, right? So they can extract themselves. And that's what I'm trying to find as intelligence, being able to, if I give you just enough information, can you extract the knowledge, new functionality, then you can consistently apply this new functionality from that point on, you can apply it to similar problems.
I like that. That's very much. Collet, I thought, was very intriguing. I think in the early days of AI, one of the examples would be if you specifically taught a AI to play, for example, checkers on an 8x8 checkerboard. And this was pointed out, I think, first by Gary Smith at Pomona. And unless you program that generality into the checkers playing thing, if you gave it instead of an 8x8 checkerboard, you gave it a 6x6 checkerboard, it would have no idea how to generalize to it. So that's an example also. Okay. Very interesting. By the way, you mentioned Fourier, so I now feel justified in referencing my book, Handbook of Fourier Analysis and Its Applications, in the podcast notes for those that want to learn about Fourier transforms. You never hesitate to advertise your books, so I will go ahead and do that. Well, this has been a fascinating talk, and I appreciate it. We're going to have one more outing with George, and we're going to conclude this podcast now because we've been going on, I don't know, roughly a half hour. So we've been talking to Dr. Yorgos Maporis about his new interesting paper, The Turing Test 2, The General Intelligence Threshold, which I think is an intriguing new method of measuring whether or not AI is going to be intelligent. I would point out that George has mentioned that his test has not been achieved. He doesn't see a path to it. I'm a proponent of the Lovelace test. That hasn't been demonstrated. And I think for the Collet that we just discussed, that hasn't been proven yet. In fact, I read that, and I don't know if this is true or not, that Collet deliberately designed his theory so that current AI approaches like deep learning and reinforcement learning would fail. And so that's kind of interesting that all of these methods for measuring intelligence are not yet here. But if you believe in Ray Kurzweil, the singularity is right around the corner. And it's been right around the corner for over 20 years. So we'll see what happens. Thanks for listening. Thanks, George. Appreciate that. We'll see you again real soon. And until next time on Mind Matters News, be of good cheer.
This has been Mind Matters News with your host, Robert J. Marks. Explore more at mindmatters.ai. That's mindmatters.ai. Mind Matters News is directed and edited by Austin Egbert. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the speakers. Mind Matters News is produced and copyrighted by the Walter Bradley Center for Natural and Artificial Intelligence at Discovery Institute.